And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, March the 28th, 2018, 3:28, 18, 12, coming up on 13 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for hour number two today. We want to thank Francois Clemens, Officer Clemens, from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for coming on last hour. That was a very interesting interview. And I thank Francois for coming on, and hopefully he will be able to come back on in the future. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun, because those of you who have listened to this show for many years, and those of you who listen to this station, probably realize that one of my favorite guests, if not my favorite guest, was legendary comedian Phyllis Diller, who was from Lima, Ohio, just up the road from here. Phyllis was always so kind to me. When she came off the road touring in, I believe, 2002, she was on the program something like 40, 45 times, just for anything. If I would call her, Phyllis would come on. She was the most unpretentious woman I have ever met, and we still air the best of Phyllis Diller on this station, the best of my interviews with her, over the years. She could not have been kinder to me in the beginning of this program, and I will always thank her for that. Phyllis passed away in 2012 at the age of 95. I actually did the last interview with her about a month before she passed away. She was on her 90th birthday, 92nd birthday, 95th birthday, and even went to Chicago, the Rosie Show, because of our relationship. Rosie O'Donnell invited me to Chicago when she was on, which I believe was her last talk show appearance, aside from the one she did here on radio a month before she passed away. Today's going to be fun because we are joined by her youngest child, and we're going to listen to some clips to remember this woman who was so good to me for so many years, and I loved her to death, remembering Phyllis Diller with her son Perry. Perry, how are you?
I am fine. What kind words?
Well, I don't know if I've ever told this story. We have spoken on a couple of occasions, but when your mom came off the road in 2002... I had called to do an interview with her because we had never had her on the show. And I got her manager, who is a very nice man named Milt Suchin. And I put the request in, and the request came back, and Milt said, she's going to do it, but, get everything you want in this one interview, because she's inundated with interviews since she's come off the road. And so just, make this one count. And I called and I did the interview with her. And she was gracious and just as nice as could be. And about 5 minutes after the interview was over, Carla, who was her assistant in her house, called back on her. I saw Phyllis Diller come up on the caller ID. And I thought, oh man, what did I do? And Carla said, Madame Diller just says, if you ever need her again, dial this number directly. And I even ended up on the Christmas card list. And she was, I loved her.
That was quite a list.
It was quite a list. That Christmas card list was great, but we all looked forward to it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
But she came on 40 times in that 10-year period. She was just so unique. What was she like as a mother?
Well, unfortunately, she started out and she had five kids. My dad really couldn't hold down a job. It was out of necessity that she went out and found gainful employment. And she ended up at a radio station in San Francisco. And the genesis of her really embarking on this career, she read this book by Claude Bristol, The Magic of Believing, and it was her Bible. It's about positive thinking and just moving forward at all times. And that got her going, and the first couple times she opened up at the Purple Onion, they'd call her in because she had auditioned. And after the show, they said, go home, be a mother, take care of your kids, you stink. And then another time it happened, somebody didn't show up, and they called her again. And she went up and did her thing at the time. And, I mean, she had no really practical training. She had one gentleman that helped her a little bit as far as, you know, stage presence and what have you. And in the beginning, she was doing impressions. She was on top of the piano, dancing, and doing all sorts of stuff. Then the third time they called her, it clicked. And she basically was taking a page out of what Bob Hope was all about. Stand in front of the audience with a microphone and just tell your tale. And it clicked. And that was really her education in comedy. She was there for 89 weeks.
Mm, what an amazing run. As a mother,
yeah.
How was she as a mother? Was she a strict mother?
Well, she was a sweet one, but she was working so much. We had a lady, Mabel, who we called Sugar. When we got out of hand, you know, she was babysitting all of us. So she'd give us candy, and my teeth will show you how much sugar I had back then. Mom was so busy, and then as she was taking off, she couldn't bring five kids with her on the road. So my sister just above me, Stephanie, and I, we were laid off in St. Louis with my aunt and my grandmother while Mom traveled. By this time, the oldest, my brother Peter, was in school at Washington University, and slowly her career was going. And the magic moment, quite honestly, is when, and I'm sure you're the one that's aware of this, is when Ed Sullivan and Jack Parr were having a very big fight over who was going to be a guest on their show, and people were siding up. Ed Sullivan back then was paying like $3,000 for guest appearances, and Jack Parr was paying Union Scale, which was like $180 or something like that. Well, Mom made jokes about both of them, and that appeal worked. She didn't offend either one, and she was on both shows nationwide, and just like that, it was like a rocket taken off. And then she got even busier. And then in, God, 64, we moved back to L.A. And I'll never forget, we were looking at a house, and we were running up and down the halls, all of us kids going, Mom's rich! She hit the big time. So that really was the beginning of my relationship truly with my mom. She would write letters. We'd talk on the phone. But as a little kid, if you don't have somebody around you, you know, it's really hard to have a relationship, but, you know, she was always there. She did the best that she could, but her whole path was kind of designated. She really chose it, and she went with it, and she had to make certain sacrifices. And as you know, anybody in show business, number one is their career, because that's their empowerment and everything else. So she really took off and was having a ball, had a TV show, you know, had money like she never had before, and she came from such humble beginnings. So at that point, I got to get to know her, and in my 20s, I always went over every Monday, and we'd play cards and lie to each other and laugh. And, I mean, we'd get to laughing so hard that the help inside of her house would be laughing at us laughing. From that point on, it was just an open book. We talked about everything. We had so much fun. She was my best friend.
She was a very unique woman, because if you saw Phyllis Diller on a television show or in a movie, it was the fright wig, it was the gloves, it was the outrageous outfit. But she was a very fashion-conscious, different woman in real life.
Well, she was truly almost like a Renaissance lady. She really had all the acumen of somebody much higher up, almost like a blue blood. Her English was impeccable. You know, she got around with everybody. Her main suit about her personality was her kindness. She always appreciated his fans. You know, it kind of went from there.
She, I want to play a clip here, because something that went hand in hand with Phyllis Diller, because she was the first really to bring it out of the closet, was plastic surgery. And I don't know if people remember this, but back in the early 2000s, I think it was, Donda West, Kanye West's mother, died in a plastic surgery complication. And Phyllis...
Oh, yeah, Toadie Fields, Joan Rivers. I mean, it's very, very unfortunate. And these were some of them were supposed to be simple procedures, but it's kind of scary.
Absolutely.
And just to bookmark you real quick, is there was a time that I went to see her after she had her first surgery, and her face was like a mummy, and they'd done a peel and all this, and she had a deviated septum, so they fixed and straightened her nose. They did her neck, and she was one of those people that wanted to get as much done at one sitting. So we walked in, my sister and myself. My sister immediately started crying because she looked like she'd been beaten up with a bat. And I looked at her, I said, "Mom, are you comfortable?" She goes, "No, I'm not comfortable, but it's something I wanted to do." And she did, and she was back before the doctor said she should have been working. And she was a workaholic. She loved what she did, and she couldn't wait to get back out there. So she was amazing when it came to that, and her healing powers were incredible. I'm so fortunate to have her genes because, I feel like I'm in pretty good shape, and she made it to 95, and she had a ball. She touched all the bases and had such a successful career, and I'm so proud of her.
Here is a clip of Phyllis Diller on our show, early 2000s, talking about plastic surgery.
But it was kind of interesting because Phyllis Diller kind of always played on this, "Hey, I'm ugly" image.
Well, baby, let me put it like this. I used to get so much revenue for playing witches. That's witches, as in Halloween. And, darling, after I had that first beautiful facelift, I never again was offered a witch role.
Is that right?
Now, that tells you a lot.
It definitely does.
And my social life improved.
You know, that's what I was going to ask you. What does it do for you mentally?
Mentally, I couldn't tell you what a lift I got from having regular features instead of a crooked nose that was too long. And that is where I got all the witch rolls. It was my nose. It had been very badly broken and never fixed. And the doctor, on his own, because we hadn't even discussed doing anything but fixing it, he bobbed it, meaning he shortened it. And it was the length of my nose that was getting me all the witch rolls.
Wow. That's very interesting. Were you ever scared going under the knife for all of that?
No, by then I had read The Magic of Believing and learned that fear is a negative emotion. I've learned how to live without fear.
You know what's interesting is I'm sure you weren't the first person to have plastic surgery, but you were the person who made it.
I haven't, so.
Right. But you were honest about it. Why were you so honest about it?
Because I'm an honest person. It just never occurred to me that it was unusual. It didn't occur to me that it had to be a secret. It became a part of everyday life. I simply brought it out of the closet accidentally.
Phyllis Diller on this program in the early 2000s. Perry, was she insecure about her looks before that?
No. I mean, the humor that she built really was her protective barrier. And she was always popular since high school, college, and what have you, as being the funniest person in the room. Everybody would gather around her. But she was self-conscious about her looks and always wanted to be, the beauty in the whole thing. It's funny she mentioned The Magic of Believing in that clip. I have to tell you, though, Mom's friends would fly in. They would see the surgeons in L.A., have the work done, and then Mom, it was basically like a hospital. And I go to have lunch with her, and I go, "Who's in the library all bandaged up?" She'd go, "That's so-and-so from New York." And I said, "There's a lady out in the living room reading. Who's that?" So these people didn't want everybody to know that they'd had some work done, you know, and everybody's telling them they look so rested and they look so great. And Mom was so good about that because she understood that that's just the way they were. Also, I have to share with you, I was in corporate banking, and there's a AGC, which is the Association of General Contractors, and they gave her the contractor award for the biggest improvement. She got a special award because of her work that she had constructed on her face. So, but she had everything. On one of the shows, they listed all the stuff that she had because Mom really tried to make herself unattractive when she was on stage. She had big boobs. She would wear dark clothing so that wouldn't accent that. She would spread her legs a little apart and make them look like chicken legs. And I got into the dynamics. I said, why the gloves and the shoes and all that? And she was the first one to even have a mini skirt. The crazy hair. She said the clowns wear gloves for a lot of reasons. She said, I thought I'd incorporate that. I said, you're not a smoker. Why the cigarette? And she saw that so many of the male comics were using cigars, George Burns, Milton Berle, you know, for timing mechanisms where they would set up a line and they'd, you know, like pretend they're dropping off an ash and then they would deliver the payoff. So she incorporated all that. She was a real student of comedy and, you know, she was in the Guinness World Book for, I think it's like 12 to 14 lines in a minute. Which is, I mean, you really have to motor through it. And once she did a setup, then she would top the jokes, and you just see the audience dying. And then she would have to wait a couple seconds for them to catch her breath, and then she'd go back to it again. So it really, she was just amazing. And it did everything for her self-esteem, and that was so important, and that was such a great benefit. And so she went out and she talked about it, and then the plastic surgeons in L.A. had a great night for her. Like I mentioned, the contractors gave her that award, which, you know, was a prize award, and she thought that was hysterical. But I think it came down to self-esteem. When she was like 8 years old, she stole the family car and ran it into a fence and broke her nose. So she was a wild little only child that had to entertain herself. Her parents were much older. Her dad was close to 70. Her mom was in her 50s when they had her. So, you know, they didn't have the energy or the gumption to stay up with Mom. So she was just a fireball in her youth, and I think that's where her imagination took over, and she just had a ball, even if she's going to be just by herself.
It's interesting. There's a documentary, Good Night, I Love You, that chronicles her last performance in 2002. She was 85 then. Why did she decide to come off the road?
Well, she had had a heart attack in 99, and she had a pacemaker. So it kept everything at an even rhythm. She'd get on stage, and the adrenaline would kick in as the audience would respond to her act. And they'd be laughing, and it would pump. And then she would get lightheaded. And then she turned to the audience at one point and said, you know, that joke was a lot funnier the first time, wasn't it? And the audience just appreciated her honesty and laughed again. And that's when she called me up. She says, you know, you've always said if I ever wanted to take the oars out of the water, I could. She says, I think it's time. And I know she missed it so desperately, but she moved on, positive, went down a new road, started doing artwork, and she would go to her studio and just go up there and go nuts. Sometimes she would have a gin martini late at night and go up and do some of her real creative work. So she always had fun. There was never any question in my mother's mind that she was not going to be successful at anything that she wanted to do. So I think that's something that paints a nice picture that all of us should, you know, try to emulate.
As I say, the documentary highlights her last performance, and there was a lot of talk. I think even her manager in that said they thought she'd be emotional about it. And she really, in the documentary, we don't see her becoming emotional. She walks off stage and that's it. Did you feel there was a lot of emotion involved there?
No, and I was asked, how is your mother going to be? Do you think she'll make a speech at the end of it? I said, no. Mom is the consummate professional. That morning, she did the sound check. She did the spots where they were, the play on, the play off from the musicians. She always, always did that. She never missed it. And she knew her act. And I said, when she's finished, she will just leave the stage just like she always has. And she won't have any fanfare. She's not going to try to milk it or anything. I'm up there to make them laugh. I made them laugh. I did my job. I don't need to make speeches. I'll let my work, you know, stand on its own feet, and we'll go from there. So I knew that she would just be a pro. And I flew up there to surprise her. And when she saw me, she says, how did you find time to get away to come up here? It was like, you know, her manager thought she's going to be all excited. And he says, they got a special guest. And I think she thought it was Bob Hope or somebody. She turned around and looked at me. She goes, well, crap, I see him all the time. That was wonderful.
The 10 years before her death that she was retired, 2002 to 2012, mm-hmm. What was that like? What was that time period in her life like?
She, was with her friends. She did her art. She still had a lot of interviews. There was a lot of interest. She said, I'll just be forgotten. I said, oh, Mom, I don't think so. And she was always, again, honest about it. She says, I wasn't the first stand-up comic. There were other women. They just weren't successful like I was. And, you know, she would never take away from anybody's thunder. And she appreciated, like I said, her fans. She just loved. And I remember one time at an airport, and this is before we got into the Middle East situation and everything else, there was a party of like five or six people from the Middle East with, you know, the garb over their head and the whole thing. And they said, oh, Miss Filler, you know, you're so popular with our whole family. Can we get a photo with you? Each individual gets a photo with me. That was my mom. She was so kind.
Was she a good grandmother?
Oh, God, she loved the kids. She loved them. And it was sad because at a point, my kids were old enough that they were working, they were in school, and then they went out and got gainful employment, which made her always happy. But she was great, and she always made time. I know any time I would call, no matter what, she says, always put Perry's call through, no matter what. And she could be on another line with whoever. Because she just wanted to talk, and we would just cackle and just have fun. It was just immediate. And we both had each other's number. We knew the triggers, the buttons, and everything else to get each one going. And like I said, we get laughing so hard sometimes that the help in the house, we could hear them upstairs and in the kitchen laughing, just at us laughing. She had a great time. And, you know, You go through this life, and boy, did she, like I said, she touched all the bases. And I would tell your fans or anybody that's a fan of my mom's to get the book, Like a Lampshade in a Whorehouse, by Richard Buskin. And it really inspirational story from the beginnings of Ohio on the farm, and her making her way and all the trials and tribulations. Because when she started out, you got to remember, she was the only female. The guys did not like her. She didn't make friends with all the heavyweights till years later, after she proved she had staying power, she was funny, and then they all loved her, and they all referred to her as the kid. She was, you know, the Friars Club. They did Sophie Tucker and Lucille Ball, and I think one night they did Elizabeth Taylor, but Mom was one of their own, and both in New York and in L.A., they roasted her, and back in the old days, they would shut all the doors, tell all the, you know, waiters and bellboys get out of the room, and I mean, it was filthy, dirty jokes, but funny, and it was all, you know, in jest, and she was so proud of that. She says, the boys love me, and the reason the New Yorkers really wanted to get her, this is typical of Mom. She went down to Sears into the boys' shop and got a suit, a three-piece suit, got somebody to do makeup and put a mustache on her, And she broke into the Fires Club, an all-male institution, and sat at a table and saw the show. And I said, well, what did you do when you had to go to the bathroom? She said, I went in the men's room and got in a stall. But David, some women were really irate that she had broken the code, and they wanted to get even with her. And it was almost like they wanted the comics that were up on the board to really go after her. And they couldn't have been sweeter. And some of them just could not bring themselves to say anything nasty or dirty, even in joking around. But she was always ready for that. She's always ready to laugh, and that's what I loved about her.
It's very, and I want to underscore her kindness. Not only did she come on the show a lot, there was a moment. And I read The Magic of Believing because she talked about it so often. And I think this was a highlight of that, what she believed, to encourage somebody as Bob Hope encouraged her. I had done an interview back in 2010 with Helen Thomas when she was thrown out of the White House press corps, and it got a lot of national attention, was on CNN and all that. And I started.
Oh yeah, we all loved Helen. She just was great. She was a cornerstone of the press there.
Oh, and when I did this interview, it was on all the cable channels, and Phyllis agreed to come on. I was doing my first show after that, which was a big show to come back. And this is how, now, me here in Ohio, this is how she responded. This is Phyllis Diller coming on right after the Helen Thomas thing.
I've been sitting around here in California, from Ohioans, sitting around in Hollywood, wondering, when is the international public going to find my friend, the great interviewer, Scott Spears?
Well, Phyllis, we wonder the same thing. You wonder it from Hollywood, I wonder it from here.
Well, I swear, Scott, you see, we are so aware of your great talent because you come up with hundreds of ideas. You are never wanting for an idea. You are prolific. You're always pushing. You're always there. And I thought, now, why hasn't the world found Scott and put him on a pedestal? And, you know, after all, Larry King can't live forever.
Now, she did not have to do that. I'm telling you, she was great.
I love it. Well, Scott, I got to tell you, you should have been a newsman. You're the most persistent person I've ever met. My dealings with you, your audience should know, when you want something, you get it.
Well, you know, she...
But I love that, and Mom loved that about you. And she said he asked the most interesting questions, and he gets you rolling, and you just kind of forget you're even doing an interview. It's like you're talking to a buddy. And that's the magic of a good, good interviewer.
Well, I'll tell you, when Phyllis Diller comes on and you're in Ohio and says something like that about you unsolicited, you say, wow.
Oh, baby.
You start to think about yourself for a second. And her book was so honest about your father, about your siblings. She didn't have an easy life.
Sure.
Didn't have an easy life.
Yeah. No, there was, you know, and everybody has bones in the closet. Everybody has their moments. There's always speed bumps, roadblocks, and even walls that get in our way sometimes. But you learned how to negotiate that. And Mom was just amazing when it came to that. She, I remember when my sister died, and I mean, it was a shock. She had, you know, I mean, she passed like in 20 seconds, but she was so close to my mom. And at the time, she was even working as my mom's personal assistant because she knew her inside and out. And it really was a great relationship. But Mom, I mean, oh God, she grieved. But in 2 weeks, it was just like, my God, she's ready to roll again. And, I mean, if you brought up Stephanie, you know, we kind of stayed away from that subject matter. It was like, okay, that's history. Let's move forward. And she did, always. Nothing could keep her down. And she got around town. People just adored her and loved her. It was just, it was something else. She's, you know, like I said, I'm so proud of her and her legacy. And for all the people in Marion, and I know you're close to Lima. I didn't find out till after she passed, she was sending checks to all the public services, the hospital, the library. I mean, it makes me emotional. The firefighters, the police. I mean, that's the kind of woman she was.
I think, Perry, I've thought about this a lot because I think she just... I don't think she ever... left Ohio in a way. I think she always understood people were in need. I remember one time, I don't have the clip, but we were talking about healthcare in one of our conversations, and she understood. She wanted everybody to have healthcare, even though she had made her money and she was doing fine in retirement. She was a very unique woman. She was very hard to explain because she was very complex, but boy, she cared a lot about other people.
Yes.
And one thing I remember is she was, would have been 94. I was in the audience, her last talk show appearance, I think her television. She flew to Chicago at 94. You were there with her.
I was with her. I said, Mom, the air flight will kill you. Much less doing the show. And it was a great show. And as you recall, they had, you know, all the people that had traveled through the years with her on the road. And their group was called the Dust Spiders. And they would have these reunions where they would tell stories. And it was just incredible. And Mom would have so much fun. But it really speaks to her kindness that these people would want to get together to be with her, laugh, and some of the stories were just so outlandish. There was one time she left a hotel where she had played in Texas, and I guess there was a heating pad that she needed. She was not feeling well, had a little sore throat and the whole thing, and, you know, the show goes on. That's one thing Mom would always do. Well, they kept on sending this heating pad to the next destination, wherever she was. Well, this heating pad had more miles than most people travel in their lives. By the time it finally caught up to her back in Los Angeles at her home, she went, "This is not my heating pad, it's the hotel's." It's crazy.
But she went and I don't know if you had known this, but they had contacted me because some of the interviews were available on the internet at that point and said, "Can you come to Chicago? It's just a little ways here," and sit in the audience. So I got to experience her live and in person. We didn't get to meet because I know she was in a hurry that day, but what a show that was. I know, I'm so sorry that didn't happen, but they said she went down to have a drink with Rosie, which was, that was okay by me.
Yep. Like I said, I was there, and it was really incredible because the two of them, peas in a pod, and I mean, the lunch was just hysterical. It was, "Can you top this?" Rosie would say something, Mom would say something over it, we'd all be laughing, and Rosie come right back. It was wonderful, and what she did, that show was out of love. And it was a wonderful experience for Mom. She so enjoyed it. And it was important, because at that point, you know, she was thinking that, boy, I'm being forgotten, and that was bothering her. And I said, "Mom, you'll never be forgotten. Your legacy is clear. It's going to stand the test of time. You really were the first, and you weren't one of those celebrities that was full of themselves." I would see her spend so much time. We'd leave a restaurant signing autographs, taking pictures, and now with everybody having phones, doing the selfies and everything else, she was so patient. And she was in all the high click groups. Her boyfriend, Robert Hastings, a prominent attorney here in Los Angeles, they had a 10-year love affair that was adorable. And he had the largest law firm at the time in the world. And so he brought on all the blue bloods from Pasadena, and she introduced them to all the riffraff gypsies in the show business arena. And they love merging their different cultures, and they would just have so much fun. It was amazing. And this one time we were leaving Spago, and Pete Wilson, the former governor of California, we'd had dinner with him and the ambassador to Mexico, Jim Gavin. Oh, my God, we had so much fun. And as we're leaving, some people were saying to the former governor, "You look a lot like Pete Wilson." But they're all crowded around Mom. Nobody could take that away from her. And she was just, every restaurant I went to after she died, everybody came over and told me a story. And it was just unbelievable. The maitre d's, the dessert chefs, I know at Spago, I think that was one of the last birthday parties. I guess that was like the 90th or 91st. And the pastry chef did such a great cake in Mom's image. She had her come out, talk to her, have photos taken with her, tilt the cake up and the whole thing. And I'm sure this woman has those photos in her home and is so proud. But all these people would tell me stories, and it was just incredible, all the fun, all the positive, the kindness, and everything else. And to this day, when I go to the nice restaurants with a lot of Mom's friends, they treat me like a celebrity. It's just amazing. But here's a woman that, you know, in her life, her opening act at the Purple Onion when she first started out was Maya Angelou. How does that happen? That's when she was doing calypso dancing. And then Barbara Streisand opened for her in New York when she was 18. You know, so her history and her story and the people that she knew and met, it's just incredible. And I always feel fortunate. I tell people I'm kind of like the cross between Walter Mitty and Forrest Gump, because I can't believe on the periphery of her spotlight that I've enjoyed meeting and being introduced to such wonderful people.
Oh.
And as you know, there's people in this business that are not the most positive and not the most fun to be around, but Mom was one of the great ones, and she would attract other positive, wonderful people, and we always had a ball, always had so much fun.
She
was just great.
She was tremendous, and as I say, she did this appearance on Rosie O'Donnell in, I believe it was October of 2011. She was 94 at the time. And kind of after that, into the preceding year, she slowed down a little bit. What was going on in those last 6 months? Was she happy? Was she still maintaining her life?
My mom had the happiest death anybody could have. I took care of her. I always promised her that she would pass in her home. And I had two assistants, Shelley Sparks, oh God, who was with my mom just for years, an angel, and another woman. And we would rotate, and I moved into the house by this time, and we had monitors. Mom's whole bedroom was set up like a hospital. We injected her with the, you know, the things that she needed. When hospice finally came by, they said, "You don't need any hospice. You guys are doing just a fantastic job." Mom and I would go out in the evening to her porch, which she referred to as the Calvin Coolidge porch. She had a name for all of her rooms. The front bathroom was known as the Edith Head. I mean, you know, everything about it was just fun. But we would sit out there, and sometimes we wouldn't even speak. It was like a park-like setting in her backyard, and she loved that. And other times we'd put on Sinatra, jazz, whatever. And what was so special as I go, okay, I got to know, I don't want to find out anything that you have a love affair with Mr. Ed or Lassie or something like this. So I want to ask questions. And she says, fire away. And there's going to be stories and people I'm taking to my grave. And I promised her that. So she really opened up. And we would sing. We would have fun. She would have the people come around. It was just amazing. And all of her lady friends, they would go out on the Calvin Coolidge porch, and they would have their high noon tea and just, you know, sit and gossip and have fun, be all decked out. And she just had a ball. I mean, we really had a great time. What really was happening, Scott, was that she was having a series of strokes in the end. And it would incapacitate her in certain areas, sometimes the left side. Sometimes it would reconnect again. But on her final evening, we would just plan her breakfast, just with one of the hallmarks of her day. what she's going to have and everything. And Shelley came in to me and she says, Madam, and everybody called her Madam. I don't know how and why that stuck, but Madam, it can't speak. And I went in and I knew she had had another stroke. So I said, you okay? You in any pain? And she's nodding, no, I'm fine. And I said, you know, this is kind of interesting. I think for the first time in my life, I'm going to get the last word in. And as I said, this little feeble finger came up outside of the bed. She flipped off her own son. And I said, I stand corrected. It was amazing. But that's Mom.
What? And the story that ran the final day was that when they walked in that morning, or you walked in, that she had a smile on her face.
She was looking straight up at the heavens, and she had a smile on her face.
It's interesting. It shocked me a little bit, even though she was 95, and this is the story, and I want to play this clip because I think it's important. We had not done an interview, and it was almost a year, but she'd always come on about her birthday time. And it was her 95th birthday, and I had called Carla, who was the assistant, as I always had, and she said, I could tell something was not right, because usually it was, let's book a time and we'll do the interview.
Right.
And
right. It's like when Scott, when we spoke, I was being very protective of Mom, because I knew that she wasn't, 100%, and she wasn't going to do anything unless she was. And, I said, she's going through her stuff, and you don't want to put it out on the news. Nobody that's alive wants to hear about their impending death. So I was very protective of her, and you were very sweet and considerate during that time, and I appreciate that.
I was so glad you included me in that, but she did come on, but you had told me, you had just met, you had said, listen, this is what's going on. We'll go on with that. So you might want to tape it. And because we want her to look her best, and there was no edits to the tape, by the way, for all who listen, there was no edit. But this is 1 month before Phyllis Diller passed away, and this is when I knew all would be well with Phyllis Diller. This is from July of 2012.
Phyllis, at 95, does death scare you?
Oh, golly, no. I died 3 times.
Yeah, I remember that after your heart scare.
So I'm an expert. I'm good at it.
What's dying like for those of us who don't know?
It's very restful and peaceful, and there's nothing to it. You just pass out, and that's it. And with death, it's just that you don't wake up.
Do you go anywhere?
No, you don't go anywhere. So don't count on it, folks. I've known that for years. Don't count on going to heaven. Because I ain't none.
Now, when did you come to that conclusion?
When I was very young, 3 years old.
Why was that?
I realized that it was a bunch of crap.
Well, now, Phyllis, I saw you on Biography doing a ghost story. Do you believe in ghosts?
Well, for the money they gave me, I did temporarily.
That's the best answer I could have asked for. That's perfect. So the money was right.
Oh, boy, was it, darling. And I just adored my ghost.
Oh. And that's true. And I called up. I said, I see you're doing this ghost story. I go, Mom, you're an honest person. And she said, I swear, was a mercenary for a paycheck.
He
said, I did the show, and at the moment, I believed in ghosts. She took it on as a role, I guess, as an actor.
That was like 3 minutes into the interview, and I thought, oh my goodness, Phyllis is going to be just fine.
Now she would tell me, she says, there's no white lights, there's no nothing. She says, the only part that I believe in is dust to dust. She says, all we really physically and are aware of is when we're here, and that's the time to do your best. So if there is another place we're all going to go, live a good life, and they'll just take you in. You know, she wasn't a religious person, but very spiritual. And she believed in basically kindness, karma, and everything that was right. And I think that's how we need to live in a chaotic world that we live in now. Oh, my God. Just to be nice, respectful to others is so important.
And I want to make mention that was 30 days, a little less than 30 days before she left us. And when she left us, the tribute, you know, a lot of time you do tribute shows to people and people are busy with their own lives. Everybody, Maya Angelou came on, Marty Allen came on, Hugh Downs came on, Rip Taylor came on, Jane Meadows.
She went to school with you.
He's
a Buckeye. You all know that. You got to be proud of that man. Gee whiz.
Oh, she did two jokes that I love that I always told her, and one was about Lima. She says, people call it Lima. She said, but you don't eat Lima beans. I love that. Go ahead.
If mom hadn't been an entertainer, I think she would have been a school teacher, and she would have been gnarly because she would correct you, and even at the last minutes of her life, she was correcting my English. No, honey, remember? And I mean, I was at a sit-down dinner with like 14 people in her home, and there was a newscaster there. And she, told him, I said, no, you don't say it like that. And I took her aside and I go, I thought you're supposed to praise people in front of others, but take them aside when you have to talk to them about maybe a little negative aspect that they need to know about. She said, no, everybody needed to learn the lesson. And I taught him the lesson and everybody was there to enjoy it. And it kind of made it more of a human moment. I thought, you know, she's amazing. Gee whiz. She thinks this stuff through, and she's not going to have any mercy on somebody. If you're doing good, she's going to let you know. She's going to applaud you and give you an attaboy. If you're not, I remember I had a report in high school for algebra, and I missed the test, and I got on my report a D. And all she wrote underneath it was the S word, Perry, with an exclamation point.
You know, it's funny.
That conveys the message.
Oh, yeah, that'll put it across. You know, when I think about that, I remember she used to come on it when George W. Bush was president. She'd say, you know, why does he say nuclear? It's nuclear.
Oh.
She was about that. And the joke that, and it's a smart joke, it's so smart, it was they asked Fang to be a Jehovah's Witness, and he said he couldn't because he didn't see the accident.
I hadn't heard that before. Well, she had a great line about President Reagan, and he and Nancy were buds. And Mom would send letters to every single president, Republican or Democrat, whatever, because she knew they had a tough job, and when it was really a tough time, she would send them something to kind of build them up. But she had a joke where it was somebody was commenting on President Reagan's beautiful alligator shoes. He was barefoot.
Oh, she had some...
harder than anybody.
Oh, my. I love it. Perry... I loved her to death. All these years later, she's no longer with us, but how do you remember Phyllis Diller? How do you remember Mom?
Oh, my God. Just, it'd be hard for me to put into words. Incredible, loving human being. That's such kindness in her heart. And, I mean... I turned her on to the movie Babe about the pig with James Cromwell. She could not watch a movie where there was violence, blood, shooting, anything. When she saw Babe, she would always thank me. She's the greatest movie, and the little mice and everybody else, and the little pig thinks he's a dog. She just loved that. And she was just so true to her own heart and her whole being. With nothing but positive energy.
It truly was, and I want to end on this story because I think a laugh was if you think Phyllis Diller could not ad-lib in, she was doing a Christmas special one time, and we had her on live from, it was a live show, so there was no stopping. And
That's dangerous.
Oh, boy. We had a show that night, and Gallagher, the comedian, was traveling through the area, so he was in studio. So those two on this Christmas special kind of get going back and forth, like joke for joke with each other. And it's a Christmas show. And at the end, she laid him to waste because he said something about, I'm putting together a list of comedians. Where do you see yourself? And that's what started it all. But at the end, right. she said, because he said something about, you don't go back to the mom's Maybelline days. And she said, I'm so old that safe sex at my age is having the nurse put up the sides of the bed.
Oh my God.
And I thought, well, Merry Christmas. And that's where we went.
Take that to the church.
That's right. She was the best. God bless her. I miss her a lot. I miss her a lot. Perry, I know you don't do these often, but I'm glad you came on because it's fun remembering that wonderful lady from Lima, don't call it Lima, Ohio.
Lima is a diamond. Yeah, thank you so much. Scott, you've been such a wonderful supporter of my mom, and you've always been so sweet, and I appreciate your honest evaluation of her life, and I can't thank you enough.
And she still airs on this station. An Hour of the Best of Phyllis Diller hits the repeats quite a bit here because people still love to hear her. Thank you, Perry.
Wow. Thank you, Scott. Take good care.
You too. Bye-bye. Perry Diller, the son of Phyllis Diller. That's all for today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Streaming live on the internet at WWGH1071, just like before, .com.